The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
I sit and look out upon all the sorrows of the world and upon all oppression and shame. I hear secret convulsive sobs from young men that anguish with themselves, remorseful after deeds done. I see in low life the mother misused by her children, dying, neglected, gaunt, desperate. I see the wife misused by her husband. I see the treacherous seducer of young women. I mark the ranklings of jealousy and unrequited love, attempted to be hid. I see these sights on the earth. I see the workings of battle, pestilence, tyranny. I see martyrs and prisoners. I observe a famine at sea. I observe the sailors casting lots for who shall be killed to preserve the lives of the rest. I observe the slights and degradations cast by arrogant persons upon laborers, the poor, and upon Negroes and the like. All these, all the meanness and agony without end, I, sitting, look out upon, see, hear, and am silent. Of course, this is a famous poem by Walt Whitman. I sit and look out. In a way, it's an aspect of the First Noble Truth, where we begin. We sit and look out and experience. We come into practice, and now we sit and look in. Because the Buddha said, that's where the revolution has to begin. That's where all of the sorrow that we see in the world is coming from. And so I wanted to talk a little bit today. A couple of weeks ago, I meet every month with students and practicing members who want to show up and take up different aspects of Dharma practice and teachings. And on that Saturday, I said, how is the practice, how can it help you to meet today, this very today that we live in, these particular lives of each of us in this time and place, this country, this point in history, within samsara, how to live our vows to alleviate suffering when there's so much intentional greed and anger and hatred and delusion and confusion. And so I want to share a little bit about that. That was a kind of free-flowing mando, and in which I shared some of my own perspectives and thoughts around this. It's something I think a lot about. It's something the teachers speak about a lot. And both in terms of our own internal experience, but also how as a sangha, how as a community, how as teachers, do we bring forth response? Do we speak about, recognize things that are happening that we're in the midst of within Buddha Dharma? And so Whitman begins here with looking out on the sorrowful world. He sees, hears, and is silent. And Whitman, of course, was not a passive person. He was very dynamic, very engaged. And so I think we also need to, I hear that, not as a retreat, not as a turning away from. He is sitting and looking out. And this is what he sees. In a sense, this is where the path begins for most of us. In Mahayana Buddhism, we could say it begins with Hakuin's Song of Zazen. From the beginning, all beings are Buddhas, like water and ice. Without water, there's no ice. Outside of us, there's no Buddha. How near the truth, and yet how far we seek. Like somebody crying, I'm thirsty. Like the child of a rich parent wandering poor on the earth, endlessly circling six worlds. The cause of our sorrow is our self-clinging delusion. From dark path to dark path, we wander in darkness. How can we be freed from this wheel of samsara? And so, what do we know? as Buddhist practitioners. Well, the Buddha made it very clear that this path is examining deeply at its fundamental level, what are the causes of suffering? And suffering being a very deep, dukkha, being a very deep, broad, in a sense, inclusive term that incorporates anything we can experience, that when we cling to it, when we create self and other, when we solidify it into something that has its own intrinsic qualities and characteristics, dukkha, suffering, disappointment, dissatisfaction will appear. And so we study the causes of suffering, and therein begin to discover how to free ourselves. We know that attachments to negative thoughts and emotions are deep and strong. If you don't know that yet, keep sitting. That our established patterns of speech and behavior are deep and strong, and that they influence us. They can govern, seem to govern our actions. At times they can overwhelm, eclipse, until and unless something else interrupts, some countervailing force, influence. We know that every practitioner who's practicing experiences the reality at some point that the path requires a sustained and sincere and skillful effort to shift these old patterns. We begin to recognize that we cannot control our mind, though we try. That just leads to more dukkha. We cannot control it, but we cannot be passive either. And in that, we realize that we can't control other people's minds either. I cannot make anyone self-aware. I cannot make them more mindful, and I cannot make them let go. I cannot make them take responsibility. I cannot make them care. And this is true whether I am deluded or enlightened. It's true whether the person is deluded or enlightened. We do not have that control. We see that Buddhism doesn't prescribe. It doesn't tell us what to do. You don't get a manual, right? An operating manual as a Buddhist practitioner. So when you run into a jam, just check the index. Family, work, world, right? Then sub-index, what kind of family, work, situation. You don't get that. Nobody gets that. It doesn't tell us what to do. It doesn't tell us how to respond. It doesn't tell us exactly how to live and fulfill our vows. Well, we could say the teachings and the practice is constantly pointing to that, but it's pointing to ourselves, to sit and look within and discover the stuff of that within ourselves. And so we see all of these things that Buddhism, in a sense, isn't, which is important to clarify. So we're not practicing under false assumptions. And now the way becomes more clear to all of the vast possibilities that actually exist. And so if we think of internally, which is the direction that we are pointed in when we begin practicing, turn inward, turn the light around. How do I stop the suffering? There's a koan in the miscellaneous collection of koans that koan students work with, which is exactly that. How do you stop the suffering? It's very simple. It's that direct, it's that complete. But it's not asking for ideas and strategies. It's pointing to the essence of liberation. How is suffering alleviated? In the Prajnaparamita Sutra, the Buddha said, when we attached to the different aspects of ourselves, the skandhas, we're bound in those attachments. That's why in the Heart Sutra, which we chant essentially every day, it begins with Avalokiteshvara declaring that those skandhas are empty. They don't exist as something. So whatever we attach to, in whatever way we impute a sense of self into the skandhas, that's an illusion. If we impute the skandhas into my sense of self, that's an illusion. It doesn't actually exist. No one has ever found the self in form, in a sensation, right? In a discriminating thought or awareness, in a mental formation or an action or in self-awareness and consciousness. And the Buddha goes on to say that a practitioner who is releasing themselves, freeing themselves from attachments, needs to practice by realizing that the skandhas are empty, but also the Buddha says that it does not occur to them as a practitioner in terms of the paramitas that I give a gift. I give a gift to you. This is the gift that I give. In other words, the Buddha is saying the practitioner isn't reifying the self in the act of giving, the receiver in the act of receiving, the gift itself. None of those have any inherent existence. They're empty of self-existence. They don't think, I guard morality. This is the morality I guard. Through this, I guard morality. And they don't, in a sense, turn morality into dogma. Rules, fixed rules. You're either right or wrong. You're inside of this or you're outside of this, and so on. And he said the basis for this is what is described as the 20 kinds of emptiness. The emptiness of inside, of outside, the emptiness of emptiness itself, of dharmas, of characteristics, and so on. And so all dharmas, forms, expressions, manifestations of emptiness. A magical display, right? Things that in every moment, in every appearance, that has nothing fixed or solid. And so the Buddha said, all things are impermanent, which is just a way of speaking about emptiness. They're impermanent because they're not fixed. They change because they're not solid and independent. In the Lakavatara Sutra, the Buddha said, the self is not within the skandhas. The skandhas are not within the self. They are not as they are discriminated. That is, when we recognize, name, compare, or act upon, the self is not in any of those actions. And the Buddha said, nor are they otherwise. The reality of an object is seen being discriminated by the deluded. We see an object, we discriminate. It's this, it's not that. It's over here, it's not over there. It's high, it's low. He says, if this were true, then we would all be seeing the truth. If we were all seeing the truth and living in accord with that truth, shouldn't the world kind of give a big hallelujah? If we're all living in truth, then we should all be living peacefully, harmoniously. The Buddha says, as all things are without permanent existence, there's no defilement, no, nor purity. Ultimately, things are not as they are seen, but they're not otherwise. And so when any person discriminates another in the slightest way, in the most significant way, divides them in any way into something inherent. They are, you are, this or that, into high or low, good or bad, intelligent or ignorant, complete or insufficient. If that were true, then seeing people, things that way should lead us to living in harmony with those things. Well, that doesn't seem to be the case. If that were true, then we're wasting our time here because things are fixed. There's nothing we can do about it. We can practice because everything is empty, because nothing is fixed. So what can we do? What are we doing? I was reading a book recently, actually by a person who used to be a student here, who was writing about complex systems, and they said, it may seem, he was talking about authoritarianism, and he said it may seem that somebody who is an authoritarian, a dictator, a tyrant, who wields a tremendous amount of power over a population, seems to that everything comes from them, that they're the source of all of that power. He says, but instead, they're in the midst of a vast web of connections and relatedness that that person is dependent upon. That that form of government, that all of the actions, everything that's happening is dependent upon. Which is pointing to that there are, in a sense, an infinite number of webs of connection that are required for that to be taking place. Which is another way of saying that there are an infinite number of nodes, of flex points, of potential shifts. We could also say that there's a web of resistance, right? A difference of opinion. Thinking, acting, believing in a different way of being, a different way of being with each other, a different way of forming a government, policy, legislation. And so in practice, as we sit and look in, the Buddha said, we have to clean up our own house. Have to, right? Which means we have to see where our house is messy. And so we begin by not adding, not creating more greed, more anger, more delusion, more deception, more fear, more pride, more numbness, dukkha. So having been to some measure in the dukkha creating business most of our lives, right? We're now charged and invited and empowered and guided in not doing that, right? And we see it's not so easy. But that's our practice. So when we sit, as we are this morning, and every impulse that would separate or divide or would rank or would judge or would love or would hate, what do? We don't reject. That's more dukkha. That's more division. That's more of the same. We don't grasp and cling. That's more dukkha. That's more of the same. We relax. We abide in a non-abiding state. I don't abide in rejection. I don't abide in grasping. The revolution has begun. And so being in the midst of samsara on display within us, and we have to acknowledge that, around us, that has been transmitted down over centuries, right? Samsara, in every time, in every age, was the world practitioners lived in and practiced with and met and faced. But what also has been transmitted down to us since the Buddha is how to live within, transform, liberate, respond to samsara. And the Buddha said in the Prajnaparamita, the question is asked, someone who wants to guide others, instruct others in enlightenment, provide an example, who wants to encourage them. And it doesn't have to be, and here it's the Buddha Sutra, so it's the Buddha's path, but it can be just how to live a better life, how to not create more harm. What do they do? How should we encourage them? The Buddha says, do it. Said, if you want to do that, fill that person, those people, with enthusiasm for it. Raise their spirit. Well, what can bring forth our enthusiasm? Well, one thing that can help is to bring forth discouragement at creating more pain and suffering. When we are discouraged from doing that, we can be encouraged towards another possibility. He said, but in encouraging them, and of course this applies to ourselves, first and foremost, we should do so with a mind that is in agreement with reality. And that's, I mean, in a sense, that's the whole thing, right? Everything else, Eight Gates, Eightfold Path, 2,500 years of teachings, is how do I do that? How do I think? How do I speak? How do I act in agreement with reality? If I want to live a peaceful, harmonious, joyful life, I have to do it in accord with the way things are. And also in such a way that when I'm doing that, I'm doing that within accord with the teachings, right? Because reality is like, where is it? How do I follow its example, right? So the teachings provide us, in a sense, with that map, that pointing. And at the same time, the Buddha says, as I'm doing that, I should not produce discriminating thoughts such as, I am. I am doing this for me. I am doing this for you. Because I'm doing it, I'm just a little bit better than you. Because I'm not doing it well, I'm just a little bit worse than you. So we practice by facing reality, the whole thing, all the time, every moment, whether we like it or not. And that's kind of a big part of it, right? I don't want to. Please. Thank you. I'd rather not. And so we have to meet that impulse and turn back again, come back again. Because this is the world we have. This is the time we have. This is the person I have to work with. I don't know how long I get this. So I'd rather not waste time. So each day, each encounter, what do I need to do? How can I bring myself forth? This is how I live. This is how I think. In a sense, this is my burden, and this is my opportunity. You have to find yours. So, the teachings say, the Vimalakirti teachings say, use your Buddha field. Where do you find yourself? Where do you roam around? Right? Where do you go each day? Who do you encounter? What kind of work do you do? Who do you have influence over? Some Buddha fields are large, some are small. Dogen says, when the need is small, you use your field, you use everything you have in a small way. When the need is large, you use it in a large way. And to think about, I mean, these are just things that I have reflected on. I reflect on all the time. The dualistic mind, the dual mind, the this and that mind, tends to see things in terms of they are whole or they're incomplete. They are broken or they're fixed. I am succeeding or I am failing. Right? It's kind of tyrannical. You get a choice. Choose the right one. Don't screw it up. You're screwing it up. What do you do now? Right? That dual mind is a killing mind. It is a failing mind. It is a mind of defeat. It cannot ultimately help us. If you're fixing a toaster, repairing a punctured tire, there are a lot of things where there's a process, there's a recognition of something, there's a process, and there's a repair. Yeah. But that's not what we're struggling with, right? If that's what you're struggling with, just check out the manual that nobody ever reads, right? Go on YouTube. Somebody will have done it. They'll show you how. This is not on YouTube. If it is, don't listen to it. Because when we see things that way, then anything I do to meet something that is clearly broken will fail. I can't fix this. I can't fix our current administration. I can't fix people who are starving in Gaza. I can't fix our climate crisis. I can't fix those problems. So anything that I do that would actually might help is not fixing the problem. So what's the point? So if I attach to that view, and it's so easy to see the mind, and oftentimes we may not think of it that way, but in a moment of discouragement or disappointment or just feeling helpless, I think oftentimes we can see that's what's actually happening. I think I have to fix this. I have to do something that takes that away. So if I attach to that view, I cannot serve. But if we continually aspire to live, to practice, to affirm life, to give generously, I can do that. I can do that. I can give generously. I can practice being truthful. I can practice seeing perfection rather than ranking you as high or low. I can do that. And those things are actually in agreement with reality. Those things are, in a sense, descriptions of how the world works. I mean, I think of it in terms of how do I live with my attachments? Right? In the beginning of my training, when I had aspirations, I wanted to free myself. Right? I wanted to be a monk, and I thought, I might not be a good monk. I might be like dud, you know, whatever that means. I thought, I have to consider all the possibilities. I didn't want to come in assuming my dream was a reality. I was going to realize, what if not? Can I live with that? What if I never resolve this burning thing inside of me? What if that never becomes peaceful? I realize I need to consider all the possibilities. Don't be fooling myself, deceiving myself. My strong attachments, my emotions, my negative habits. But then I realized and just lived every day, yes, all of those are there, but I can practice them. I can have an aspiration to free myself completely. But if I hold on to that too tightly, then I am broken, that's fixed. And any single action I do is not fixing the problem. So that mode of thinking, which I carried for a long time and caused me a lot of unhappiness, had to shift. When we first, as children, encountered death, a pet, a family member, a friend, and we realize, oh, I'm going to die too. What do? We live. We live now knowingly with that knowledge. Hopefully we don't fool ourselves. We do. We pretend it's not going to happen for a very long time. I've got time. Or it's going to happen, but I've planned it. I've even scheduled it. Right? I know what's going to happen. We can fool ourselves that way. But as practitioners, we, I hope, don't do that. So when we encounter the reality of death, I cannot control that. I live. How do I live? If I try to keep fear outside the door, that doesn't help. It gets stronger. It's confirming that whatever I'm afraid of, I should be afraid of. Therefore, I should keep the fear outside the door. So one way that I've worked is to take that fear, the worst fear, and bring it in. This is one of the possibilities. I could be a shithead monk. I could never find peace, right? I could end up living in a totalitarian society. I could watch people all around us lose their rights. I could watch ongoing cruelty, right? And I cannot fix that problem. So I bring that into my mind and realize that is an actual possibility. It would not be the first time. It has happened, I guess, since we've been settling down and providing people with the power to accrue power and accrue wealth and control others. People are living in such regimes right now. It could happen. I don't want it to happen. But I let that into my mind so that I'm not trying to keep that possibility outside the door, because I find that doesn't actually help me. It's like visualizing your death. It's just a visualization. It's just a mental image. But it, in a way, it helps make it real to us. It doesn't make it happen, but it makes it more real. It brings it inside. So now I can sit and look within at that, so that when I look without and see signs of that, they're still distressing. I don't want them to be happening. But I'm not creating a barrier where I cannot see that. That cannot be happening. Because that's one possibility. And as I face that reality, then I realize there are also many other possibilities. Just like when I'm encountering my own delusion, that's one reality. There are other realities. So it doesn't limit. And as I consider taking that worst fear, that worst outcome, to be careful that that doesn't somehow shift into a kind of passivity or complacency or defeatedness. This path is not about that. There's no teaching that you'll encounter that says, okay, it's time to give up. It's time to quit. It's hopeless. Can be done. I dare you to find a teaching that says that. So I may never realize complete enlightenment. I may never be a moment-to-moment, wholehearted, selfless, compassionate person like Avalokiteshvara. That's one possibility. If I dwell in that, that's just a mental image. Right? It doesn't make it real, but it has an impact. And there are other possibilities. And so I can aspire. I can actually apply that energy towards today, towards what I can do, to where I actually am. And so in moments of speculation, of proliferating thoughts, I can ask myself, is this helping? So when I read the news or I hear images or I see images, right, that are so heartbreaking, so disturbing, there are no words for this. And then I see my mind seize on that and create its own, my own world within myself. It is not people starving in Gaza. It is not this or that. It is my mind creating, is that helpful? Is that serving anyone right now? When I dwell in that, no, it's not. Does it help me to know what is possible? It can, if I seize it in that moment and begin shifting. It's like regret. The Buddha said, regret is like a guardian because it brings our attention to something I have done that I now regret because it was hurtful to somebody else. So in that way, it's useful, right? It gets my attention. And it continues to be useful if, recognizing that, I then shift my attention to reflection. What did I do? What were the conditions that made that fertile? What can I do now? But if I dwell in it, it's no longer useful. So recognizing that reality, feeling the emotions, the grief, the anger, the despair, the hopelessness, and realizing those emotions make sense, right? They're valid. I am feeling them. How can I use them? Be careful to not be used by them, to be crippled. And so then to bring forth in that moment, okay, all of this is happening. I am here. I cannot fix the problem. What can I do? How do I want to live? What is my field of influence? Can I reach beyond that? How can I serve? And I think of that as a living question. It's like a living organism. You know, for somebody who comes into practice and really takes this up, we have to recognize certain things. I spoke about that at the beginning. We have to be willing to recognize whatever forms of dukkha are within us, the things that we have done in our lives we're not happy or proud of. And it's painful. We have to live with our delusion while we're trying to unburden ourselves. We have to live with our lack of compassion and the way it affects others as we're trying to liberate our hearts. And so within that, the ongoing question, I have to learn how to live with that weight, that apparent discrepancy. I aspire to this, but this is where I'm seeing. And I have to try and keep unifying. This isn't the good self, this isn't the bad self. This isn't the improved Shugen, this isn't the inferior Shugen. It's one thing, complex, with 100,000 points of meeting, of interconnectedness, of relatedness, which means an infinite number of points of entry, of contact, of shift. We call those moments. And so I think of that as a living thing. It's not so much, can I get rid of this burden that I am carrying? You know, I think if a person is not experiencing some degree of sorrow, of sadness, of grief, are they paying attention? But how do we hold that? That's the thing. And how can that, because it's not a thing, right? And how can I take that energy, which just could become, you know, a black hole that doesn't help anybody, and honestly turn that into an enlightened life, a liberated life, a service life? I think of how in every situation, you know, a flood, an earthquake, a war, there's a whole host of people who are involved, right? There are people on the front line, first responders. There are people way in the back doing really, really important stuff. Has to be done. And then there's everybody in between. Small actions, large actions. Right there in the face of it, sitting back, but doing something that needs to be done, that is serving, that is helping. I think of it as, you know, when we do caretaking here and we each get an assignment, no matter what it is, it's one of those nodes of not just relatedness and connection, but it's the way this becomes possible. And so to think, you know, of ourselves in terms of what, you know, what is my situation? And some people change their situation. They go to that place. They reorder their life. Some people do that. They're born that way. They're made that way. Other people are different, right? Some people are drawn to a very active, activist-oriented life. Some people are drawn to a very inward, contemplative life. In a sense, as practitioners, we need some of both, right? And yet to work within our own sort of internal as well as external Buddha field, if you will, which again sort of frees us from this notion of there's a right way and there's a wrong way. Are you the right kind of person or are you not? You should be doing this, other people, but you're not. So it's all or nothing. It's to think of all those sort of defeating thoughts, those defeating mind states, those defeating views. The Bodhisattva hears the cries and responds. How? That's the work of each one of us. And it means carrying, holding the suffering that we're trying to alleviate while we experience it, practice, live our lives, and respond in some ways. I mean, what's the option? Go numb, turn off, tune out, or just get mired. In either case, we're not helpful to ourselves or others. So to hold the tension, sort of a healthy tension, natural, essential tension, in order to live and live our vows without falling into complacency or a kind of tormented restlessness. And so Hakuin says from the very beginning, Buddhas are like water and ice. They're not separatable. The cause of our sorrow is ego delusion in ourselves and others. How can we be freed from the wheel of samsara? He says the gateway to freedom is Zazen Samadhi. And he doesn't just mean tranquility. And he doesn't just mean sitting on the cushion. One of the things the teachers have talked about is, you know, how to respond. Because over the years, when things happen, sometimes people will say, you know, we need to make a statement. We, the Sangha, we, the teachers, you know, and sort of give a voice. What is happening? What is our response? How do we sort of position ourselves in relationship to that? And for years, for a number of years, I would do that periodically. And, you know, and so that meant, you know, like, when is that appropriate? When there's a mass shooting, is it how many people have been killed? When it's a flood or a famine or an earthquake, how many people were affected? And it's like, is it by scale? If it's a war, how big is the war? You know, it's like, how do we, what are the metrics of that? And it was not a good way to think of things. And when I did do things, or when we did do things, oftentimes, because people have their own perspectives and own feelings about things, it would meet with criticism. It's too much, it's not enough. So we tried some different ways of thinking about it. And then we put on the front page or the first page of the website this teaching from the Dhammapada. Hatred is never appeased by hatred. By compassion alone is hatred appeased. This is an eternal law. And I thought that is just so correct and powerful and simple, and it includes everything. What's the event? This response to it. Small and large. But we continue to talk about it and feel like, yes, and is it important? Would it be good for us to respond to specific things? To somehow give voice to that? Right? And so we've been talking about sort of bringing that in to the website in some way, just so that a voice is being heard. Because I recognize how I respond to that when I hear someone, you know, particularly if they're coming from a wisdom tradition, a faith tradition, or they're just speaking what seems to be true or needed. I realize how that affects me. And so we've been talking about doing that, and we actually haven't gotten together to put that together, so I just went ahead and did something. So I'm going to speak about this in terms of we, but this is really just my own words, and we'll talk about it and see. And again, it's a way of, in a way, for me, it's a way of taking, you know, what I experience within myself, and in a sense, because of my role, what I experience within this community of loving, compassionate, wisdom-seeking people. In the midst of today. As a Dharma community, we vow to liberate all beings from the many forms of pain and suffering. Each day we practice this vow through our training and cultivation of the great virtues of the enlightened mind, our patience, generosity, kindness, compassion, courage, and faith. We aspire to awaken from our delusions and to manifest selfless wisdom and compassion in all directions. And each day we must face the moral and spiritual challenge of living our vows as we witness the anger and cruelty and aggression and violence that we see around us. And so we commit ourselves to ceasing from harm and to evoking compassion towards all those on the receiving ends of that cruelty and violence, and also towards those in seats of power who, instead of using their influence to bring benefit and well-being, actively create webs of fear and distrust, division, animosity, and greed. Yet invoking compassion must also include doing what we can to stop the violence, prejudice, aggression, and use our respective areas of influence, be they small or large, near or far. And while we may each seem insignificant in the face of worldly samsaric power, we are not without influence. And so within the Mountains and Rivers Order, we condemn the systematic killing and starvation of those living in Gaza, as well as the violence past and present by Hamas and other terrorist organizations against the people of Israel and other countries. May this violence and the patterns of attack and retaliation cease, and commitments to peace and stability come forth. I consider Russia's invasion of and war against Ukraine to be a crime against Ukraine and every nation's right to be sovereign and self-governing. Let us recognize that every action, policy, institution, and government around the world and in our own beloved country that prevents each person's ability to pursue a life of respect and dignity not only transgresses against the teachings of the great wisdom traditions of humanity, but transgresses against our basic human nature and profound interdependence. We have the capacity to liberate our bodies and minds and hearts from our deluded self-clinging and false views. We have the capacity to simply be kind. When nurtured, every living creature will seek life and freedom from pain. May we reflect on how we can bring greater compassion and wisdom into our lives, the lives of others, and our worlds. And may we realize the Buddha together. And so I wanted to end, coming back to Whitman's poem, with a little bit of a coda. He ended his poem, "All these, all the meanness and agony without end, I, sitting, look out upon, see, hear, and am silent." This silence is the depth of my unquenchable love for you, for this, for all of it. It is the quiet that knows the essential good, that, though sometimes dim, is never distant, though often unspoken, is ever alert, though given, can take time to receive, though received, is sometimes met with distrust. So let's be courageous, O friends, and have faith so we may all find our way here together.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.